Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Sunday, the 5th of May. Efforts to secure a ceasefire in Gaza have intensified, with Hamas holding talks with mediators in Egypt. Israel says it's waiting to see progress. Flooding and landslides triggered by days of heavy rain in Brazil have left nearly 60 people dead. And Argentina calls for Spain's transport minister to be sacked after he implied the Argentine president had taken drugs during his election campaign. Also in the podcast,
one of the sort of knock-on benefits from that downturn was that we had stocks that was maturing to a much higher age than it may have been allowed to if we'd been producing at the same levels.
The revival of Scotland's so-called ghost whiskey distilleries. Floods and mudslides have continued to cause devastation in Brazil's southernmost state of Rio Grande do Sul. At least 57 people are now reported to have died and dozens more are missing. Rescue teams in boats and planes are searching the ruins of collapsed homes, bridges and roads. Thousands of residents have been forced to flee since the storms began last Saturday. Suzeta Pereira is one of them.
I lost everything. I lifted some furniture that I could. But I believe I lost everything. I really am desperate. It's the first time this has happened.
Meteorologists have predicted further rains to come. David Bamford has more details.
The extreme weather affecting the state of Rio Grande do Sul has been caused by a rare combination of hotter than average temperatures, high humidity and strong winds. In Porto Alegre, the regional capital, the Guaíba River broke its banks, submerging entire neighbourhoods. The international airport there is closed. A hydroelectric dam near the city of Bento Gonçalves has collapsed, and a second dam is also in danger of failing. More than half of the nearly 500 towns and cities in the state have been affected by the storms, with roads and bridges destroyed in several areas. At least 500,000 people are without power and clean water, with further rainfall expected. Brazil's National Institute of Meteorology attributed the increased precipitation to the climate phenomenon El Niño. President Lula da Silva has visited the region, promising help from the central government.
David Bamford. The unprecedented rains are also believed to be contributing to an all-time high number of cases of dengue fever. More than 4 million people have been infected with the mosquito-borne disease so far this year. Scientists say the steady increase in cases over the past 2 decades is linked to climate change. More than 2,000 people have died in 2024. Mauricio Nogueira, a professor of infectious diseases in Sao Paulo, told us why Brazil had been hit so badly.
We have what was a perfect storm for a dengue virus. New dengue virus being introduced in the country. The dengue 3 variant shows up again after 10 years. Dengue transmission goes down at the moment that we have our first cold front of the winter. This cold front has not happened yet. We are seeing exactly the opposite. We are having a lot of heat for this time of the year. And the outbreak, instead of being over by now, is still going on. In some places, they are still increasing the number of cases. Since São Paulo is the most populated city in the country, this is putting our numbers up really high. We have water everywhere, and if we have heat and we have water, it's almost impossible to control the Aegypti mosquitoes. And this mosquito is just getting more frequent in the whole world because of the global heat. Dengue is a severe disease. We have fever, headache, cramps, muscular pain, and also can be fatal. It's about 0.1%, but when you're talking about millions and millions of cases like we are seeing in Brazil, this becomes quite important. There is a couple of vaccines in the market. WHO recommend the use, but they are not available on large scale because they were just licensed and do not affect this outbreak. Maybe these vaccines will have an impact in future. But dengue is also becoming more frequent in South US and even Europe. France have a lot of cases last year. So dengue is becoming a major global health problem.
Mauricio Nogueira, Professor of Infectious Diseases. East Africa has also been hit by heavy rains in recent weeks, leaving some 400 people dead. On Saturday, Kenya and Tanzania issued severe flooding alerts as coastal areas were buffeted by tropical cyclone Hideya. Thousands have been forced to leave their homes. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, the BBC's Anne Soy sent us this report.
A moment of rescue. There's a sense of nervousness. The man being rescued has sheltered on a tree for 5 days, stranded by flood waters in Garissa, in the usually arid region of northern Kenya. Red Cross workers have brought a boat to try and extract the man to safety. The operation is successful. In the south of the country, helicopters airlift tourists from the Masai Mara Wildlife Reserve. Rescue teams and the stranded tourists wade through the waters to get to the aircraft. Heavy rains over the past week have caused widespread floods in many parts of Kenya. Roads, bridges and property have been destroyed and many lives lost. About an hour's drive west of the capital, Nairobi, a village is still trying to come to terms with tragedy. Survivors are searching through debris and mud for lost belongings and perhaps missing loved ones. Eunice Wanjiko is holding a tattered jacket. It belongs to her missing relative's child, she says. She recognizes other household items, a broken bed, a mattress, and what remained of the roof. Her relative, Anne, is among dozens who are unaccounted for. That's why we suspect she's buried here, says Eunice, sounding helpless. At 3 a.m. on Monday, a small lake that had formed uphill after a railway tunnel was blocked broke the barrier and the water came gushing down the hill, sweeping away or destroying everything on its path. More than 50 people died, including James Kirombe's wife and child.
The water came and I felt as if something was falling. That's when the water swept us with my wife and child. I got stuck and was drenched in mud. I got up and started looking for my child. The baby had cried for a while, but I could not find them. There was nothing I could have done.
Search and rescue efforts are ongoing. This is the single most deadly incident yet. The government has been criticized for being slow to act. President William Ruto addressed the nation on Friday.
The current unprecedented crisis of floods that our country is experiencing, as well as the recent devastating drought our country faced, is a direct consequence of our failure to protect our environment, resulting in painful effects of climate change as we are witnessing today.
The reopening of schools has now been delayed indefinitely. People living near water reservoirs that are either full or already overflowing have been ordered to evacuate and a disaster response set in motion. But there's no respite yet. More heavy rains are predicted across East Africa as a tropical cyclone pounds the Tanzanian coast. With the ground already saturated, there are fears about what lies ahead.
And Soy in Kenya. Well, the cyclone reached parts of Tanzania on Saturday evening. Our correspondent in Dar es Salaam, Alfred Lustek, gave us this update.
We are still experiencing strong winds and rains in some parts of the coast regions. And this afternoon, there are a lot of destructive wind in an island called Mafia, which is around 70 miles south of Dar es Salaam. And it has damaged properties. And despite that, the local government there has not yet told us about whether it has caused death or injuries to the people there. But still, at the Dar es Salaam coastline, activities are just on and nothing has been reported to be a downfall of that cyclone. Though in the morning, A report by the meteorological agency said that the wind speed was around 120 kilometers per hour and the cyclone was as far as 128 kilometers to reach Dar es Salaam.
Alfred Lustig in Tanzania. For the past week or so, there's been growing optimism about a possible deal between Hamas and Israel, which could see a 40-day ceasefire in Gaza and the release of Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners. Negotiations intensified on Saturday with a Hamas delegation meeting Egyptian, Qatari and US mediators in Cairo. However, a senior official from the Palestinian group insisted that any agreement would have to include a complete end to the war. The Israeli government is opposed to that and has so far refused to send envoys to Cairo. But it's also facing calls from Israeli protesters in Tel Aviv to do all it can to bring the hostages home.
I'm here today to support a deal now, yesterday. We need to bring them back. We need to bring all the hostages back, the live ones, the dead ones. We got to bring them back. We got to switch this government. This has got to end.
I heard more about the latest negotiations from our correspondent Anna Foster in Jerusalem.
Hamas said that their delegation was going to Cairo in a spirit of positivity. But interestingly, they also talked about maturing the agreement. That was a sort of translation of what they were saying, which meant that there are clearly still sticking points between the two sides. And the key seems to be the permanence of the ceasefire that is being discussed. The fact that Hamas are very clear that they want any agreement to actually have baked into it, specified the idea that they will be working towards the end of this war. Whereas from the Israeli perspective, they are still saying, and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is still saying very publicly that he wants to go ahead with a fresh ground offensive in Rafah, regardless of any arrangement for a ceasefire. So that shows you that there is still distance between the two sides. And I think that is why you're seeing people like the head of the CIA, William Burns, there to see if they can try and pull the two negotiating parties closer together and come up with an agreement.
Yeah, and on top of that, Benjamin Netanyahu under pressure at home, one from the families of the hostages to get the remaining captives out, but also from hardliners in his government who want to finish the operation to defeat Hamas. Is there wriggle room anywhere for him?
He finds himself in a very difficult position. It's Saturday night here in Israel, and for months and months now, there have been protests against his government, even before the 7th of October, protests against the judicial reform that his coalition was trying to bring in. And on the point of that coalition, of course, it contains some of the most far-right elements of Israeli politics. And they have made it very clear to Mr. Netanyahu that if he doesn't go ahead with this operation in Rafah, then they will leave his coalition and the government will fall. And there'll be fresh elections here in Israel, which, funnily enough, is what many of the protesters on the streets are calling for. Those two things can't really be reconciled. So it does raise questions about how Mr. Netanyahu and how Israel will proceed to try and appease all of those different sides calling for different things.
And briefly, current conditions in Gaza, the WHO saying the threat of a famine hasn't gone away.
No, that's right. They said that by May there was a good chance that famine would be declared, particularly in the north of the Strip. The situation there is dire. There have been new aid routes that have opened just in the last week or so, but it's fair to say that there still is nowhere near enough food in Gaza, and that will continue to be the case until it comes in much larger quantities than it is now.
Anna Foster talking to me from Jerusalem. Some restaurants in the US that have spent the past couple of years trying to recover from the pandemic have had the task made harder by a rise in crime. Faced with robberies, violence and vandalism, some are wondering whether they may be forced to close. The BBC's Sophie Williams spoke to some business owners, including Kevin, owner of Guy Chicken and Rice in downtown San Francisco. Last month, his restaurant was attacked, causing around $10,000 worth of damage.
Within 7 minutes, took everything that they wanted from tablets, cash, goods.
A number of restaurants say that with fewer people working in offices and coming to downtown areas after work, crime is adding to their woes.
We didn't expect the pandemic. We got through it. And now we're dealing with the crime rate that has gone up.
Kevin is determined for his eatery to remain open, but other people are making the hard decision to close their restaurants.
or in the East Bay, another restaurant closure due to safety concerns. We're talking about Denny's, says it is closing their Oakland location after 54 years.
Sean Kennedy is with the U.S. Restaurant Association.
It has certainly been getting more difficult in recent years with an increase in violent crime. Restaurants have the lowest profit margin of any business on Main Street. And so when you add to their already low margins that they have to do increased cost on security and safety, it makes it that much tougher for a restaurant to be able to keep its doors open every month.
Washington, D.C. is another area where eateries are feeling the strain. Local news outlets here are frequently reporting closures. Swati Bose is co-owner of Flight Wine Bar. She says that the low footfall in the city has exacerbated the issue.
Even people coming back to office 2 days a week or 3 days a week just wasn't enough. So we had a lot of boarded up buildings in our neighborhood. And then you have a huge displaced population. So the homeless population in Chinatown is pretty significant. Sort of the feeling around the metro stations right around us, I think people started feeling unsafe and so started avoiding those metro stations. And I think that's where the crime aspect sort of does come in. Our guests started telling us, getting to you is getting hard. Walking through that metro station and coming to you just doesn't feel great.
Others have taken crime-preventing measures into their own hands. Fritz Brogan is head of the Mission Group that owns several restaurants here in Washington, D.C.
The number one issue we hear about right now when speaking with our staff and our customers is crime. People are nervous about being out. We've worked with our neighbors to hire off-duty police officers every day to stand outside the restaurants to make sure people feel safe, to help walk staff to the metro or to Ubers or to their cars, and just sort of help give the perception that things are getting safer.
With chain restaurants also affected, there's been a big push to try and get this resolved. The National Restaurant Association says it's been working with politicians to try and counteract the effect of crime.
We are cautiously optimistic that we're in the right direction and that we'll continue to be one of the safer areas that people can visit.
And that was Sean Kennedy, ending that report by the BBC's Sophie Williams. Spain's foreign ministry is attempting to calm tensions with Argentina after the Spanish transport minister, Oscar Puente, suggested the Argentine president, Javier Milei, was a drug user. At a panel discussion in northwestern Spain on Friday, Mr. Puente suggested that Mr. Milei had ingested substances during last year's election campaign. The Argentine leader has hit back, as I heard from our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
Well, you can safely say that Javier Milei was not impressed at the suggestion he may have been on drugs. He issued an official statement from his office accusing Oscar Puente of slander, but also laying heavily into Spain's Prime Minister, Pedro Sánchez, who's the socialist. He said that he made reference to corruption allegations that prompted an investigation into Pedro Sánchez's wife, which caused Mr. Sánchez himself to briefly consider resigning. I hasten to add that the prosecutors in Spain have recommended that investigation be dropped for lack of evidence. Mr. Milei accused Mr. Sánchez of undermining Spanish unity. That was a reference to an amnesty deal with Catalan separatists that helped secure him his minority government in power. He accused him of jeopardising Spain's middle class, alleging his policies led to poverty and death. And he accused him of also of jeopardising Spanish women, making without any evidence whatsoever allegation that their physical integrity was at risk because of his policies on illegal immigration. And he urged Spanish people to reject socialist policies and models and choose, as he put it, to live again in liberty.
So it's fair to say the Argentinian president has gone on the offensive. How has the foreign ministry in Spain responded?
Well, they issued a fairly short statement in response. It basically spoke of two things. It flatly rejected President Milei's accusation, but it moved swiftly on to say that the remarks didn't reflect relations between two fraternal countries and peoples.
Now, he is, Javier Milei, is expected to go to Spain in a couple of weeks. Could be a little frosty.
It could indeed, especially if he's meeting government figures. He's due to attend the party conference of the far-right Vox party in Spain. It's expected to be an endorsement in many ways of the leader of Vox, Santiago Abascal, who attended Mr. Milei's own inauguration in December in Buenos Aires. And all of this happens just ahead of the European parliamentary elections, where the nationalist right is hoping to do well.
Now, they're both Spanish-speaking countries. Are they normally close?
They are. There's long-standing tradition. Spain, obviously, is the former colonial power, but there's long-standing cultural and historical relations and also good trading relations as well. So although there's no love lost between the socialist-led government in Spain and Mr. Milei, who's a libertarian anarcho-capitalist, who's a big cheerleader for Donald Trump, the country's relations hopefully will survive these sort of ups and downs.
Danny Eberhard. And still to come on the Global News Podcast, the North Korean propaganda video, which has become surprisingly popular on TikTok.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe, from people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Mayor of London is the most powerful directly elected politician in Britain. The job served as a launchpad for Boris Johnson to eventually become Prime Minister. Now, Sadiq Khan of the opposition Labour Party has become the first London mayor to win a third term.
We ran a campaign that was in keeping with the spirit and values of this great city. A city that regards our diversity not as a weakness, but an almighty strength. And one that rejects right hard-wing populism and looks forward, not back.
Mr. Khan had already made history in 2016 as the first Muslim mayor of any Western capital. He hasn't always seen eye to eye with the rest of the Labour Party and has faced plenty of criticism over crime and his clean air policies in the capital. But in the end, he did enough to secure a comfortable win. I spoke to our political correspondent Rob Watson about the significance of the victory for the main opposition party.
It had been a rather ugly campaign. Essentially, his main rival was a woman called Susan Hall, the Conservative candidate, very much on the right of the governing Conservative Party, and it has not been a pretty contest, to put it mildly.
Now, London has, of course, seen huge protests over Israel's military operation in Gaza. There had been suggestions that Labour's position on that conflict could reduce some of Sadiq Khan's votes, but overall, his share went up.
Yes, so that didn't materialise. Neither did some other things that Labour were worried about. They thought that maybe people in London would be complacent of Labour winning just because the polls suggested that he would win. There was some concern about some of his policies aimed at low emissions in terms of cars and the sort of taxes that they have to pay. But none of those fears materialised, and he is re-elected. And as you say, it's pretty extraordinary, really, to become the first mayor to have three terms as mayor of London. There's a screaming message from these results, and that message is they confirm what the polls have been suggesting for the last few months, and that is that the governing Conservatives, Oliver, they are just spectacularly unpopular. I mean, you just couldn't describe it any other way. And what that means, of course, is unless that there's some utterly dramatic turnaround in the Conservatives' fortunes, they seem to be heading for defeat in that general election, which is expected sometime between now and January 2025. That is absolutely the message, the unpopularity of the governing party.
Our political correspondent, Rob Watson. A new documentary film called X Trillion, about to be released globally, highlights the worsening issue of plastic pollution and how dangerous chemicals are getting into the human body. An all-female crew travelled by boat to the most isolated parts of the North Pacific. Here's an excerpt.
We've got an albatross that's just come to say hello. I'd actually prefer to not see albatross here because you know that they're swooping down onto the surface of the ocean looking for squid, which basically look the same as these white plastic fragments that we're seeing on the surface of the ocean.
The film's director, Eleanor Church, spoke to Paul Henley.
What we found was just this incredible, beautiful, blue, vast ocean. And every now and then we did see a chair floating past or a toothbrush or a cigarette lighter or something like that. But then when we put a trawl through the water, what we brought up were thousands and thousands of tiny pieces of plastic, which ultimately had been something that someone on land hundreds of miles away had used. But by the time it had reached the North Pacific Gyre, which is also known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, had broken down because of the journey that it had travelled and been bashed around by the waves and the sun breaking it down to these tiny, tiny particles of plastic, which are actually our biggest threat. Because ultimately, the big bits of plastic, you can go and scoop up. But we found, on average, 500,000 pieces of microplastics on the surface of the water in a square kilometre.
And the point is, these microplastics are finding their way into us.
Exactly. So I think there's more and more research that shows that we're breathing in microplastics or nanoplastics, that we're ingesting it through our food, through the water we drink, through all sorts of different ways. Also, plastics have a lipophilic quality, so they attract pollutants that we have in our water systems already. So from flame retardants or fertilizers or pesticides, and they bioaccumulate in our bodies. The point of the expedition and of the film really is to make people think about what we can all do in different ways. And it's actually a very optimistic and uplifting film.
What was it actually like on board?
It was extraordinary. Some nights, you know, there'd be phosphorescence on the crests of every wave for as far as you could see and a million stars in the sky. And other nights, it was, you know, storms, lightning, terrifying. But it was a very unique experience to go to one of the most remote places in the world. We were closer to people on a space station above us than we were to people on land. We didn't see another boat for 3 weeks. It was just an extraordinary thing to be so far away from civilization, but ultimately surrounded by all of this plastic and traces of humanity.
Eleanor Church talking to Paul Henley. In Scotland, whisky distilleries that had closed decades ago are now being reopened thanks to a rise in global consumption and a multi-million dollar investment by the drinks giant Diageo. They've been called ghost distilleries, and many specialise in producing whiskies made from a single malt grain. Some connoisseurs argue they have far better flavour than more widely sold blended ones. Our reporter Elizabeth Hodson visited one of the most famous distilleries to be revived in the western Scottish island of Islay.
What springs to mind when you hear the words liquid gold? Oil, perhaps? Well, I'm going to tell you a tale about a far more palatable and equally finite resource, and that's whisky, from Scotland's fabled ghost distilleries. Back in the 1980s, an oversupply of whisky resulted in whisky locks, and dozens of distilleries were closed. One of these was Port Ellen on the Isle of Islay in the west of Scotland. And then, around the start of the millennium, something happened. Tastes and market conditions changed and whisky became fashionable. And as the popularity of alcohol from ghost distillers grew, so did the prices. For example, a bottle of Port Ellen, which you might have paid, say, $100 for back in the mid-1990s, could now easily fetch thousands of dollars. And although it hasn't produced any liquid since the early 80s, it's kept some of the whisky made before it closed. And those casks hold some of the most highly priced tipples, according to Ewan Gunn, global brand ambassador for Diageo's luxury portfolio of Scotch whiskies.
One of the sort of knock-on benefits from that downturn was that we had stocks that was maturing to a much higher age than it may have been allowed to if we'd been producing at the same levels, which ultimately led to us being in a position where we have things like 44-year-old Port Ellen Gemini.
Gemini is sold as a two-bottle set, which will cost you $55,000. Now, that's partly down to rarity and partly down to just sheer demand. And as the clamour for liquid from ghost distilleries has reached fever pitch, some of their owners have decided to resurrect those legacy brands. Names like Brora and Rosebank have risen from the ashes, and in March this year, Port Ellen was reopened by its parent company, Diageo, after a 41-year slumber. And I was one of a fortunate group of journalists to witness the celebrations in person. A sample of liquid older than myself was drawn from the cask and poured into a glass. But what of the new stuff the distiller is making? Will they succeed in replicating the glories of the past? In all likelihood, it'll be more than a decade before a single malt is bottled. So until then, the ghostly and very expensive last drops from the distillery's previous life will continue to be drunk and enjoyed by people with even deeper pockets.
Elizabeth Hodson reporting from Islay in western Scotland. North Korea is fiercely opposed to Western popular culture, even invoking the death penalty to try to stamp out foreign influence. But now a North Korean propaganda song praising the nation's leader Kim Jong-un has gone viral on TikTok. Users around the world have been sharing, commenting on, and even remixing the tune, as Will Leonardo reports.
Abacoded. That's how TikTok fans have been describing the synthy electro-sounding latest release from Pyongyang's propaganda ministry. It's replete with video with the North Korean leader greeting well wishes, soldiers dancing on top of tanks, schoolchildren clapping their hands, and doctors giving a thumbs up in the operating theatre. Lyrics include, "Let's brag about Kim Jong-un, our friendly father." Now, of course, this is a man who's promised to annihilate the country where many TikTok viewers will be watching this video, the United States. But that hasn't stopped it from gaining a massive following. User comments include, "This slaps," and its so-called success has even been compared to Taylor Swift's new release. Experts researching North Korean music say the tune is a classic of the genre. Simple lyrics and melodies pitched at vocal ranges most people are able to reach. It's also, researchers say, emblematic of the complete control the communist authorities have over artistic output in North Korea, where creative freedom is more or less non-existent, and citizens wake up every day to the sound of propaganda music being blasted over loudspeakers. But it's a different story abroad, where no one, not even the great leader of North Korea, is safe from an army of social media users who've perfected the art of trivialising political grandstanding. TikTokers have been remixing the song by overlaying AI vocals, including with those from an internet sensation, the Chinese model Jia Fei. Indeed, Kim Jong-un's image is never far from an internet meme. His idiosyncratic fashion choices have been pored over, spawning articles about his sandals and social media posts joking that he would love the Swedish designer COS, known for its flowy, oversized clothing. This episode is also a sign of how TikTok is able to launch obscure pieces of audio and video to prominence overnight. The world wouldn't have batted an eyelid at another North Korea propaganda video if it weren't for the app's users. But whether Pyongyang's propagandists will see this as getting their intended message across seems doubtful.
That report by Will Leonardo. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Rob Fanner and produced by Isabella Jewell and Stephanie Tillotson. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Up there, you have to be quick to make decisions because it's not a natural environment for survival.
Five incredible women.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
I risked my life many times.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
I had to finish it, accomplish it.
Search for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.